Hello, you're listening to Sarah Jackman presenting this week's episode of Bricks and Mortar. The court process can be bewildering, costly, and adversarial, but it can also provide closure and legal precedent. But where do claims start, and how can claimants expect them to progress? To talk me through these and other aspects of court process, I'm joined by Paul Tonkin, a partner at Hogan Lovells. Paul, many thanks indeed for joining me today. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Let's start then, if we can, just by having a look at the court structure and the different tiers of court here in England. Can you talk our listeners through the basic structure?
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to say is our structure, the starting point is it distinguishes between criminal and civil cases. And I think for today's purposes, so we're talking about civil, but there's a whole other structure dealing with the criminal justice system. Yeah. But in terms of civil litigation, the main jurisdictions, we have the High Court, the County Courts, and then various specialist tribunals. The High Court includes the Court of Appeal, which hears appeals on High Court decisions. And then there's ultimately the Supreme Court, which is the highest court in the land, and that hears appeals from the Court of Appeal. Generally, cases are usually heard by a single judge. We don't have sort of civil jury trials in England and Wales. I say it's single judge. The exceptions to that would be in some specialist tribunals where you might get a panel of two or three judges or panel members. In the Court of Appeal, you usually have three judges. And in the Supreme Court, cases are heard by at least five judges, although there can be many as 11. So, for example, the big case last year about the prorogation of Parliament was dealt with by all 11 Supreme Court justices.
Okay. And what legislation then are people working within the parameters of in terms of the court process? What's the governing legislation?
Yes, unfortunately, unlike in some jurisdictions, we can't point to a single piece of legislation which governs everything. You sort of have to patch it together from various different pieces of legislation. I think the main ones are probably there's the Supreme Court Act 1981, and that basically establishes the system within the High Court, including the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court. And so that deals with the powers that judges have in those jurisdictions and so on. You've got the County Court Act 1983, and that's basically the equivalent legislation for the county court system. And again, as I say, it deals with the jurisdiction of the different parts of the courts, the way in which judges are appointed, their powers and procedural matters. And you've also got the Tribunals, Courts and Enforcement Act 2007, which is probably the most recent bit of sort of big legislation covering the courts. And that established this system of first tier and upper specialist tribunals, which we'll come on to talk about a bit later. So they're dealt with after that. I think the other point worth bearing in mind is that although this sort of legislation underpins everything, that is then built up on top of by court rules. So we have the civil procedure rules, which sort of govern much more the sort of nitty gritty of the court procedure in civil cases in the High Court and the county courts. And then as if that wasn't complicated enough, the tribunals have their own procedural rule books. And then we also have on top of all of that, court guides. So, for example, the commercial court has its own guide, which sets out how matters should be dealt with in the commercial court. And so there are quite a lot of different sources you need to go to sort of get the whole picture in terms of how cases are dealt with.
Okay. And just thinking then, we touched on tribunals when we were outlining the court structure. Can you talk our listeners through what type of claims would typically be heard at tribunal level?
Yeah, absolutely. So the tribunal system is relatively new. As I say, the current system was established in around 2007. And the tribunals are distinguished between what's referred to as the first tier tribunal, or the FTT, and the upper tribunal. And the FTT itself divides into various different chambers. There's a tax chamber, an immigration chamber, but for our purposes, there's also a property chamber. And the FTT property chamber deals with sort of low-level property disputes, largely in the residential sector. So, for example, disputes about lease extensions and leasehold enfranchisement, residential service charge disputes, those sort of things. Although more recently, it's also in central London, the FTT has started dealing with unopposed lease renewals under the 1954 Act. It is starting to do some commercial disputes as well. And that's really to take some of the pressure off the Central London County Court, which is pretty overloaded with cases. So that's the sort of the property chamber of the FTT. And then there's another wing of it as well, which is what's referred to as the Land Registration Tribunal, the Land Registration Chamber. And as the name suggests, they hear disputes over land registration issues. So applications for adverse possession, applications to rectify the land register, those sort of things. So that's the first tier tribunal. Above them, you have the upper tribunal, and they perform a few different functions. One of those is they hear appeals from the FTT. So if you're not happy with the decision in the FTT, it is appealed up to the upper tribunal in the first instance. But they're also a bit of a hodgepodge of specific matters, which for various historic reasons go directly to the upper tribunal for hearing. And those include things like the release and modification of restrictive covenants. So an application to release a restrictive covenant is dealt with by the upper tribunal. That used to be dealt with by the old lands tribunal. So effectively the upper tribunal has taken over that jurisdiction. Similarly, disputes about light obstruction notices go directly to the upper tribunal, as well as disputes under the new electronic communications code. And one of the interesting things we've seen is actually a lot more disputes under the electronic communications code are going to court compared to the previous code. And one of the reasons seems to be that actually the tribunal process, it's a bit quicker, a bit slicker, you get your case heard a bit more quickly. And so it seems that landowners and communications providers are a bit more willing to go the distance.
Yeah, it's been interesting, actually. I mean, one of the real features of the last 12 months has been the number of cases on the code that seem to be cropping up. And certainly that seems to be providing quite a sort of stream of cases coming through from tribunal level. We've certainly noticed that.
Yeah, very much so. And I think the difference is, as I understand it, most of these cases are going through within sort of six to 9 months, sometimes less, whereas if you're having to take them through the county courts, you're a year at the best of times and possibly 18 months.
Thinking then of the county courts, I mean, you've touched on Central London. I mean, what sort of cases typically would you see going to the county courts?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess in terms of what the county courts do, so in theory, there is a single county court, but it has branches all over the country. So most sort of large towns will have their own county court. And basically they kind of on the civil side, they hear lower value claims. So that the threshold is usually £100,000. If your claim is worth less than £100,000, then you should issue it in the county court rather than in the high court. There are very limited exceptions where the claim is particularly complex or sort of have matters of public importance. But as a general rule, if you're underneath that value threshold, you issue in the county court. The other thing for our purposes is that claims for possession of land are issued in the county court, again, unless they are regarded as particularly complex. So sort of simple claims against squatters or trespassers, but also claims under the 1954 Act, either opposed or unopposed, are all dealt with by the county courts.
So at high court level then, what would we expect to see there? That's claims over a particular value, is it?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So claims over 100,000 can be issued in the High Court. And as I say, sometimes it can be lower value claims, which are particularly complex, but that is unusual. Yeah. Also, the High Court is better placed to deal with urgent applications. Yeah. So, for example, if you needed to get an injunction or an urgent possession order, the High Court has what's referred to as the urgent applications list, where, you know, in theory, you can turn up on the day and see a judge and get an order. So they will deal with those sort of things. And then there are sort of specialist things which the county court don't deal with. And an obvious example, I think, of sort of your listeners would be sort of judicial reviews, challenges to planning applications, for example. Those are all dealt with in the High Court.
The High Court itself, then, if you have a claim there, I suppose one of the things that our listeners might want to know is where will a particular claim end up? I mean, there are various divisions within the High Court. What are most relevant for the property professional?
Yeah, so I think a lot of this sort of thing about different divisions, I mean, it can all be quite confusing for those who aren't familiar with it. And a lot of it is historical more than anything else. Mm-hmm. But if you break it down, basically the High Court divides into three divisions. You have the Chancery Division, the Queen's Bench Division, the QBD, and the Family Division. You can obviously leave the Family Division to one side because that sort of does what it says on the tin. Sure. But the other two, so Chancery... historically, that Chancery was cases to do with property. So a lot of property disputes will will go to the Chancery Division, but also company law, wills, trusts, insolvency, intellectual property, whereas QBD was really sort of everything else, which in this context meant, you know, contract disputes, commercial disputes, personal injury claims, negligence claims, defamation cases. So that's sort of the broad distinction between the two. But sort of if you drill down further, you then find, for example, that, you know, that the Queen's Bench Division has within it that the commercial court is part of the Queen's Bench Division, dealing exclusively with commercial contract disputes, and that the Technology and Construction Court, which deals with construction and engineering disputes, and those are obviously ones which listeners may become involved in. So So even though Chancery as a general rule is the home for property cases, if, for example, you had a dispute about a construction contract or what was effectively a commercial contract dispute, you may well find yourself in the commercial court and the TCC. And it's worth saying that the distinction isn't always entirely clear cut. So you may have a case which could be heard in either division. And just when you issue your claim, you just take a view as to which division you're going to issue in. The reality is that the distinction, once you've issued your claim and you're within the process, the distinction is pretty limited. There are, as I said, the different courts have their different guides, so then maybe some of the rules will be a bit different and some of the case management may be a bit different. But ultimately, the basic process is the same, regardless of which division you're in.
Okay. A new development is the Business and Property Court. Can you talk us through how that works?
Yes, and the Business and Property Court was created a couple of years ago now, and the idea was that it would be a specialist court to bring together commercial and property disputes in the High Court. It is cross-division, so in effect it has both Chancery and QBD jurisdiction within it. So for example, it includes the Commercial Court and the Technology and Construction Court, plus, as I say, matters like property disputes, company law, insolvency, IP, etc. And basically the idea is that cases within the court will be heard by specialist judges who have that commercial experience, that sort of business law experience, rather than previously when you might risk you have a high value property dispute and it ends up being heard by a judge who was a specialist in personal injury claims, for example. The idea is that if you're in the Business and Property Court, you can be pretty confident that you will get a judge who has that experience. The way the court works physically is its main hub, if you like, is in London. So we have the Rolls Building, which is a brand new court building constructed a few years ago. And if any of your listeners have ever been there, in terms of facilities, IT, etc., it is much more sophisticated than some of the previous court buildings which are still in use. So you sort of get a slicker service in that sense. As well as the sort of London hub, you've also got branches of the Business and Property Court in Birmingham, Manchester, Bristol, Leeds and Cardiff from memory. So they're sort of the large commercial regional hubs have their own branch of the Business and Property Court, so that litigants in those areas can also hopefully get that sort of specialist case management.
And how successful has that been to date? Has everyone benefited from the specialist nature of the court?
I think so. Yeah, as I say, I think litigants appreciate the idea that you're not going to have to spend the first day of the trial educating the judge on the basics of property law, whatever the case may be. But also, I think probably more tangible are those more modern facilities, the more modern courtrooms, the IT, the availability of conference rooms, all those sort of things, which one has in the Rolls Building, which frankly weren't available in the older court buildings. And I think for clients attending court hearings, that's what they sort of appreciate particularly. As we're moving towards electronic, increasingly sort of electronic ways of working, electronic trial bundles and those sort of things, then the Rolls Building, it is equipped for that in the way that, as I say, other court buildings aren't necessarily.
In terms of the claim process itself, can you talk us through how that process starts and once you've actually filed a claim, what happens next?
Absolutely. So as you say, the process starts by issuing a claim form at court, and that in itself is a very simple process. A claim form is a couple of pages long. You fill in who you are, who it is you want to bring a claim against, and in brief terms what the nature of your claim is. You then issue that claim form at court and you pay a court fee. The amount of the court fee depends on the amount of your claim, maximum of 10,000 for effectively claims of £1 million or more, and obviously less depending on the value of the claim beneath that. Once you've issued your claim form, you then serve it on the party you're suing. And either at the same time as serving it or within 14 days after you serve your particulars of claim. And that's a more detailed document which sort of sets out the meat of your claim. It is, if you like, what it is you're claiming and what you say is the basis of law and the facts on which you rely to establish your claim. So once you've served those, the other side has 14 days in which to file what's referred to as an acknowledgement of service. And that is, again, a very straightforward document where they basically just acknowledge they have received the claim and they are not fundamentally challenging the court's jurisdiction, for example, but they do intend to defend the claim. So that's your acknowledgement of service. Once that's been served, there's then a further 14 days for the defendant to file a defence. And the defence is, if you like, the sort of reply to the particulars of claim. So that sets out the basis in fact or law upon which the defendant denies liability for all or part of the claim. As I say, that is usually within 14 days of the acknowledgement of service, although a lot of these timescales can be extended, often by agreement between the parties or by application to court. And so it's not unusual for that one to be extended in a large or complex claim. Once the defence has been served, there is then a possible further stage where the claimant can issue what's called a reply, which is an answer to the defence. Now, in theory, that can go on and on and on, but that's usually the sort of final stage in what we call the exchange of pleadings. So pleadings basically means the particulars, the defence, reply, etc. So that's the pleading stage. Once you've concluded that, you are then into what I refer to as the case management stage, which is basically where the court is setting the timetable for the various stages in the process which have to follow. You'll usually have what's called a case management conference or a case management hearing, where the parties will go along and sit before a judge and determine that timetable. And at that point, the court will also deal with cost budgeting, which is a relatively new process, whereby in very simple terms that the parties have to tell the court how much they think it's going to cost them to go through the litigation process so that the court can manage those costs on an ongoing basis. So when you come out of your case management hearing, you'll basically have a timetable for the next steps in the process. And what those exact steps are will depend on the nature of the claim, but the sort of common steps are you have disclosure, which is where either side has to provide the other with its documents relevant to the dispute. And those can be documents on which it relies, but also, perhaps more importantly, documents which it has which are potentially helpful to the other party's case. So you have disclosure, and then you'd usually have a direction for exchange of witness statements. So where parties are relying upon witnesses of fact to assist their case, and they'll put in a written statement of what it is that witness says. Then, if it's appropriate to do so, you will have expert evidence. So if, for example, there was a dispute over, say, valuation, each party would put in an expert report from a valuer, and the parties would exchange those reports with a view to those experts ultimately being cross-examined at trial. You often would then, just before trial, you have what's called a pre-trial review, which is basically a hearing a few weeks before the trial, just so the court can check that all the process has been dealt with and there aren't any sort of outstanding sort of housekeeping matters. And finally, once you get through all of that, you then end up at your trial, where your witnesses are cross-examined, your experts are cross-examined, and your case is argued in front of the judge.
And how long, roughly, then does it take from the actual filing of the claim to the case being heard?
Again, this depends a little bit on sort of how complex the claim is, and also what court it's being heard in. But I think if you are in, say the High Court, I would say on average probably 12 months, sometimes 18 months. I mean, it is a long process, and that's partly because there are quite a lot of stages to go through, as I've just described, but also because the resources within the court are stretched, and availability of hearing dates is limited. So often you are looking quite far ahead for the next available hearing date.
And once then you've had your hearing, how long does it generally take to receive judgment? I know there is a bit of variance, but what would be a ballpark?
Yeah, as you say, I mean, it does depend, and it ultimately depends on the judge. I mean, in some cases, in a very simple case, a judge may give what's called an ex tempore judgment, where literally they give an oral judgment straight away, and the parties furiously scribble down what it is the judge is saying. But that's unusual in more complex cases, where the judgment would usually be reserved, which means the judge goes away and writes his judgment and then releases it to the parties. I would say on average that process will take a couple of months. So most judgments these days, or certainly a lot of them, are quite long, complex judgments, and it does take judges a while to to write them. There have been a few cases in which it's taken much longer, I mean literally years in a couple of cases, but that is something that the court is trying to clamp down upon. I think it recognises that doesn't reflect particularly well on the English justice system, and actually there are now cases of judges being reprimanded where they seem to have delayed too much in issuing judgments.
Just assuming then you get your judgment, but a party wants to lodge an appeal, what would be the process there?
So the first point is you need permission to appeal. There is, in most cases, there's no automatic right to appeal. You can either get that permission from the judge who gave the judgment, although that's quite unusual. More commonly, you apply to the Court of Appeal, assuming that your original judgment was a High Court judgment, and the Court of Appeal decides whether or not to give you permission to appeal. And to get permission, you basically have to show that you have sort of a reasonably arguable case for appeal. The other point worth noting is that, usually speaking, appeals are limited to questions of law. You can't relitigate factual matters. But assuming you do get permission to appeal, the appeal is then heard in the Court of Appeal, which, as I said earlier, usually involves three judges. And they have the ability to overturn the lower court's decision if they decide it's wrong. If you've gone through the Court of Appeal, the next and final stage is to go up to the Supreme Court. The only way you can get to the Supreme Court is if the Supreme Court themselves give you permission, and they will only do so where it is a point of law of general public interest. So it's very rare for cases to go to the Supreme Court. There's about probably less than 100 cases a year get all the way up to the Supreme Court.
With an appeal, would you be looking at a broadly similar time frame for something to go through the appeal process?
I think that's probably right, actually. Yes, I would say that, you know, the Court of Appeal are very busy. They have a backlog of cases, and so a year to get through to the Court of Appeal, yeah, and possibly 9 months, another year to get to the Supreme Court wouldn't be massively unusual. So, you know, parties do have to be in it for the long run if they want to take it all the way.
Yeah. We hear sometimes of cases being expedited. What does that mean?
So that's basically a process whereby the court timetable can be sort of compressed as much as is reasonably possible, and a sort of early hearing date is found for the case. Now, really most litigants would probably want that if they're given the choice. So that is reserved for what the court refers to as cases of real urgency. Now, that can be sort of urgency in the literal life and death case, but it can also apply to commercial cases as well. So where you have a case where, you know, unless a decision is reached within a particular timescale, the party's commercial positions will be, you know, irreparably changed, then you may be able to persuade the court to expedite the case. But I think it's important to bear in mind that it's an unusual process. It's within the discretion of the court. Mm-hmm. And part of that discretion is obviously the court has to balance the needs of all litigants, and ultimately everyone thinks their case is urgent, so you do have to have something over and above that sort of normal desire to just get things resolved in order to persuade the court that your case is generally urgent and that you should effectively go to the front of the queue, as it were.
Just as a litigator, I mean, there have been obviously huge efforts to ensure that more and more cases do go to mediation or to another form of dispute resolution before they go to the court. What proportion of your cases actually end up in court?
I would say, in terms of cases that go to a full trial, very few, actually, probably maybe 5%.
Yeah.
There are a lot of cases which will go some way along the process, and as you'll say, you'll have a mediation or a settlement. But it's very few that actually go the full way to a full trial.
Part of the rationale behind that is cost. And one of the things that I want to touch on really is the cost side of things. What sort of costs are people looking at when you take something to a full trial? You mentioned the fees that go with actually, you know, lodging a claim. But just in terms of the whole process, how does that mount up over that sort of year or 18 month long process?
Yeah, I mean, litigating, unfortunately, is an expensive business. And if you think about it, you've got your solicitor's fees, you've got your barrister's fees for trial and potentially advice before trial. If you have expert witnesses, you're paying their fees as well. And yes, all these things undoubtedly mount up. In terms of the way in which they're sort of built up over the process, it's relatively gradual in the sense that your first stage is your pleading stage is not obscenely expensive. But you know, if you imagine if you're doing a large disclosure exercise, or you are having to take witness statements from a large number of witnesses, that those processes can become expensive quite quickly. And then obviously, you know, that the trial itself is where it peaks, because that's when you are paying for your barristers to be on their feet all day. You've got your solicitors involved, you've got your experts involved, and so on.
No podcast at the moment would be complete without touching on the external factors that are going on globally at the moment. Yep. I mean, to what extent has the current pandemic affected the ability to be able to use the courts and for people to manage the court process in the usual way?
Very much so. I mean, as you say, we are dealing with unprecedented times, and that the courts are no exception on that front. So what we're seeing is the court are issuing a daily update and are telling us where they're currently at in terms of their processes. What we're finding is that most sort of routine court case management, save for in urgent cases, is effectively sort of ground to a halt, certainly mm-hmm. in the county courts. And then in terms of hearings, some hearings are still going ahead on a remote basis. So I had a hearing on Tuesday last week, which took place via Skype, mm-hmm. And that actually seemed to work okay. That was a hearing sort of purely on legal points, just argument between the barristers. But I have heard of, you know, full witness trials going ahead remotely. And I think, you know, if people are wanting to get cases heard over the next, you know, however long this takes, then that's how it's going to be. And you know, people are going to have to sort of adapt to that and deal with it in that way.
Well, Paul, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today and for giving us the basics, really, of the court process. It's been a really illuminating conversation, so thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.
That was Bricks and Mortar from EG with Sarah Jackman. For more information on developing a career in real estate, see the archive of the Bricks and Mortar series at podbean.com and the archive at egi.co.uk.